Let's get started. What's that? Why Fortran today? Do people know that language? Other people know that language? And those were the good old days where you can put a go to, you put a label for each statement, and then you can go to from anywhere to anywhere. And this is Fortran, and what is this? That's the Backus Naur form for describing grammar. So the reason we show that is poor Backus passed away recently. He's the inventor of Fortran, and he also is, you know, you keep hearing about Backus Naur form in describing grammar. So that's Backus. He actually worked for IBM. Okay. So what other language do you know that's probably as old as Fortran? Lisp. Lisp is actually, I mean, based on who you listen to, Lisp might actually be older than Fortran, older and continuously in use. There were languages before Fortran that no longer exist. Nobody even has compilers for them. But Fortran still has compilers, and Lisp, of course, you know, does have compilers as well as interpreters. Okay. I gave you guys a paper that would be forming the basis for the discussion next class. I had to give you hard copy because this is a preprint. I asked this guy, this is going to show up in www 2007. It's not yet, actually the conference is in May. And so this is the one that I was mentioning last class. These guys talk about a large scale study of collaborative filtering, about which we'll talk about today. But they do this for Google News, news.google.com, okay. This is actually in the industrial track of www, and which is very surprising because normally in the industrial track, people barely ever write more than 3-page papers because they don't want to give any secrets away. Except when Selchuk wrote a paper, when he wrote a 12-page paper. That's this guy's advisor. So I don't know, by the time it actually shows up, it may well be 2-page version, but you get to have the full preprint, and we can discuss this next class as part of other things. But it's actually, I think, a nice example of a large-scale study, plus it falls very, you know, much of what we'll discuss today about collaborative filtering is sort of repeated there. And then they look at, for example, some of the issues that I keep talking about, which is they have about 100 milliseconds to do all the recommendations that they get to do. And so what works in 100 milliseconds and what doesn't ultimately winds up being the question. And using this paper, actually, we might also get to talk about some of the other things like MapReduce architecture that Google uses for large-scale coarse-grained parallelism. So how many of you know, of course, Lisp? How many of you know Lisp? Yeah. So you know MapCar, right? And map, what does MapCar do? Or map anything, essentially, does a particular operation on every element of a list. Okay. So there is this architecture. Basically, Google is stuck with gazillion machines. They're buying up more and more space, right? You know, the server farms. And they essentially can think of doing computation on each of these machines in parallel. So if there are ways in which you can do a large amount of computation in parallel and then combine the results, which is sort of what map and reduce does. So for example, so if you do map car I'll make up a function called times two to 3, 4, 5, and then reduce plus. What it would do is, it in fact it actually can do this, it's even more interesting. 2a 3b 5c, so it's a list which has 2a 3b 5c, and what MapCA does, it takes the first element of each of the list and do double it, and then you now have, out of this you have 4 6 10, and then you reduce it using plus operation, 4 plus 6 plus 10. So that's basically map reduce in Lisp. Now think of each of these operations being done on a different machine. Okay, and then you reduce the result from individual parallel machines into one single answer. That's the map reduce architecture. So they actually, much of what's interesting in map reduce architecture is how do they make system calls, etc., support what this is. And one of the interesting things is, now that you have this kind of parallelism that is easy to support, you want to look at every possible type of computation that you're doing in the search engine and see if you can write it as a map reduce computation. Okay? Because if you can reduce it, so it's like if you have a hammer, you try to look for nails to hit on, and everything looks like a nail right now. So if you have map reduce architecture, you look for ways of using map reduce architecture. And map reduce is actually useful for these kinds of scenarios, whether it's for Google or anybody, because in fact, very similar computations are done. I mean, so first of all, one thing is it's like a coarse-grained parallelism. So machines don't have to synchronize at instruction level. That's very important. And secondly, so the question is, if you can convert every one of your big time-consuming operations into a map-reduce operation, then the parallelism, the sheer parallelism, can cut down the time. Okay, and in fact, part of what this paper does is talks about how to convert certain types of clustering algorithms and certain types of collaborative filtering algorithms into map-reduce computations. Okay, which is kind of cute, because I would never have talked about it in the class. So that's good from that point of view. Okay, so we'll use that for next Tuesday. Read this up. And if you haven't gotten the paper, make sure that you pick it up, because basically they were not too happy about me giving away electronic version. So you have the, you can then copy it and send it to your friends. It's okay with me. But that's that. Okay, any questions before we go forward? Okay, so what I'm going to do today is complete the discussion on text classification and go into recommendation systems. Recommendation systems, earlier part is really content-based recommendations, which is sort of connected to text classification and feature classification, feature-based classification. And then we talk about collaborative filtering, which actually is also very close, except it has an interesting orthogonal dimension for filtering. Okay, so it uses the social network aspect of the web, so that's the, so the collaborative filtering can be thought of essentially, the content-based and collaborative filtering ideas for recommendation can be thought of as being at some level analogous to content-based similarity and link-based importance measure of a page. These were two different things, and you used apples and oranges to combine each other, right? So in recommendation systems, that's the sort of, they actually, again, are orthogonal ideas which can be actually combined sometimes. Okay, we'll actually talk about how to combine them. Okay, so one thing that I mentioned last time is the fact that we talked about naive Bayes algorithm, how to use unigram model for NBC, right? And then we talked about how this is the algorithm that essentially computes, assesses the probabilities, and given a new document, it can use the existing, the probability that it has assessed on the training data to classify it. Okay, so what it does essentially is it computes the likelihood that it belongs to various classes, and whichever has the highest likelihood, that class becomes the answer. Okay. So one issue, one is kind of, again, when you're talking about classification, as I said, it's a much larger idea, except we just talked about the kinds of classification that work that seem to work best for text-based classification tasks. And I mentioned that one, the things that, the ideas that use low, I mean, they avoid overfitting, and they try to combine evidence from multiple different features. They seem to work better than things like decision trees, which try to make decisions on the presence or absence of a very small subset of features. Okay? So it's all learning, except some particular problems have certain types of learning algorithms that are more relevant. Okay? Now, once you start talking about this, the question is, in classification literature, you understand that there is one way of reducing the overfitting problem, and one way of improving the accuracy is to select the relevant features, the most relevant features, before you start even using them for classification. So in particular, if you remember the Russell, here is actually the classic example that I normally use in the 471. So suppose you have a bunch of training examples which are describing the coin toss experiments. Okay? So it describes each experiment and it tells you whether heads came or tails came. So heads is the class that you're trying to predict. Okay. So now here are my training examples. Training example one, my shirt color, the color of the coin, and the day, time of the day, day of the week, you know, make as many of these attributes as you want, okay? And the final thing is toss result, okay? And now you have shirt color. First experiment, I was wearing red shirt. The color of the coin is metallic, and the time of the day is 6 a.m., day of the week, Monday, and blah, 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 heads. Okay, and so on. Right? Now I have a bunch of this data. Okay, now, if you give this data to any learning algorithm, it will actually try to find some hypothesis that fits. And it tries to predict coin toss in terms of my color of my shirt and the day of the week. And for any reasonable training data, if I give you, you know, 15,000 training data, you will be able to find a hypothesis which seems to fit quite well. This is the classic example of overfitting. Okay? So you know that in this particular case, you cannot, the best thing you are supposed to do is to say none of these features are relevant. Remove all these features, and then if you want to predict how my coin comes up, you know, you have your own coin, you toss it. If it comes heads, you look at me and say heads. And if it comes tails, you look at me and say tails. That's the best you can do. The only thing you should not do is keep saying heads all the time or keep saying, you know, tails all the time. Well, actually, that's also fine. But the best you can do is having your own coin, okay? Now, this brings up this whole issue that some of these, in this particular case, all the features are irrelevant. This is a pathological example. I constructed it just to make the point. But more likely than not, some of the attributes are irrelevant, some are relevant. And much of what you should do as part of learning is figure out which are relevant, which are irrelevant. Okay, and in fact, all learning algorithms try to do that. Okay, but you can help them along both in terms of their overfitting problems and in terms of their efficiency. Okay, if you just remove the useless features upfront, the efficiency is important too, because if you actually, the problem with the overfitting is it's both complex and it's stupid. that's the worst kind of thing. I mean, at least if you're being wrong all the time, don't spend too much time. Okay, if you're going to lose in the exam anyway, get done very fast, right? So what we would like to do is remove features up front so that at least the classification time will be reduced. Classification time can be reduced. And so that's the idea of feature selection. That's the general idea of feature selection. And in the context of text classification, this is an important issue because vocabulary V is basically your set of features. And vocabulary is too large. If you're talking about general English, then you're essentially saying for each of these, each of these features is a different vocabulary word. There's too many of them. Okay, and so you would like to just remove some of these up front so that A, you can reduce the overfitting problem, and B, you can improve the classification time. Okay, and so the idea would be pick some K of the features that you think are the most relevant and then use it in learning. Now, part of the point here is picking the relevant features is half of the problem of classify. Okay, so in some sense, any good classifier automatically picks the relevant features and combines them. If it's a good learning algorithm, it will pick the relevant features and combine them already. And yet, it makes sense to separate them into two phases because even if the learning algorithm is not good, even if it's not able to actually look at the feature relevance during the learning, you would help it along this way. Okay. So the idea is, so that's basically what I'm saying here. In the context of text classification, this is even more of an important issue because vocabulary is large. So you would like to sort of focus on some small subset of words. That's what you would like to do. Okay. So the question is, which subset of words would you like to focus on? Just as which subset of the attributes, the words are the attributes for us. Okay. There are many ways of doing feature selection. In fact, the simplest one that you might know already is decision tree classification. For those of you who know decision tree classifiers, right, what you would wind up doing is, let's say it's a Boolean classification problem, the training examples originally, n of them are positive, n plus of them are positive and n minus of them are negative. The total sample size is n plus plus n minus. Okay. Then in doing a decision tree, you're trying to figure out, decision trees are 20 questions, for those of you who have never heard of decision trees. Okay, so what questions should I ask so that the answers that you give to that question makes it much more easier for me to solve the rest of the problem? I'm thinking of something in my head, and so you're supposed to ask me 20 questions. So is it like, is it alive, you'd ask first, and I'll say yes or no. And then you get to ask one more question. And the fewer questions you can ask to guess what it is that I'm thinking of, the faster, the better off you are. Okay. So in decision trees, you're actually wondering, and so the questions that you're allowed to ask in decision trees are, is this particular feature's value true or false, if it's a Boolean feature? If it's a multi-valued feature, what is this particular feature's value? Is it 1, 2, 3, or 4? Okay. That's what you're doing in decision trees. Now, and so what you do normally is you look at your current training examples, and for each feature you consider, if you ask the question on this feature, in this case this feature has three possible values. So what I did was I split this big bag into three small bags. Okay, in this bag everybody has this feature value equal to 1, in this one it's feature value equal to 2, and here it's feature value equal to 3. Okay, and you can do this for each of these features, and then based on the way these bags get made up, you can answer the question which are good questions to ask, which are bad questions to ask. Okay, a simple idea would be, suppose I have two questions that I'm trying to compare, and originally I have 10 positives and 10 negatives, and I can ask one question one, which will give me 0 positives, 5 negatives here, 0, and then 5 positives, let's see, no, I think numbers are added up. yeah, 0 positive and 10 negatives here, and 10 positives and 0 negatives here. That's question 1. Okay? Question 2, on the other hand, will split the same thing into 1 positive, 1 negative here, 8 positives, 8 negatives here, 1 positive, 1 negative here. It's a no-brainer. Which question would you pick? Clearly, you would pick the first one, because if you pick the first one, you already know after the question. Based on your answer, you know in this particular case, it's all positive. In this particular case, it's all negative. So, you're done already. Okay. So, you, in essence, there is you talk about these ideas of information gain, and you can use the information gain heuristic. Okay, so one idea you could do, if you just remember the Bayesian tree algorithm, is you compare all the features in terms of their information gain, compute the information gain of each of the features, take the top k, where k is whatever number you want, and those are the best features. Okay, and then you ignore the Bayesian tree algorithm, because this is just the first part of the Bayesian tree algorithm. What it does is it picks the feature, then for each of the, suppose it picked this feature, then for each of these, it recursively does the same question again. That's what Bayesian tree algorithm does. But what we're doing is we won't do the rest. We'll just pick the feature and now give the features that we selected to somebody like NBC. In fact, actually NBC, because we like NBC, naive Bayes classifier. Okay? So that's one idea. The reason I brought this up is this is something that you already know, and you can actually use it directly. Okay, not most of you know. Okay, but even if you don't know, there is a simpler idea that I'll tell you, which also winds up being almost equivalent, but it's just one of the many, many ideas for picking features. Okay, this is the idea called mutual information between two features and two random variables. Okay. So the mutual information between two random variables A and B is defined as probability, the joint probability of A and B times logarithm of probability of A and B divided by probability of A and probability of B. Okay. Now the idea is the mutual information, what the intent that we have is for each feature F, we would like to compute the mutual information of feature F and the class C. Feature is a random variable. It can take its values randomly. And the class itself is a random variable. For some training examples, it's true. Some training examples, it's false. What I'm trying to ask is, if I tell you feature, are you able to know the class much more? Do you know much more about the class if I tell you what the feature's value is? That's essentially the question we are asking. If you do, then that's a good feature, so you want to keep it around. Okay? And so the basically, so you compute that as, so the, you know, the joint of A and B and log of, so think of B as the class variable. So joint of feature and the class times log of feature and class by the prior probability of the feature itself and prior probability of the class itself. These numbers you can compute from the training example set. You can just assess them from the training examples, right? Because of the training examples, basically this is saying when, you know, think of simplest case, Boolean features, right? So probability of A and B is saying the total number of examples which are positive and have feature F to be true divided by the total number of examples. That's it. That's all I'm asking. Okay? And similarly, this is one of the probability of A is the total number of examples where the feature is positive, period, divided by the total number of examples. Okay? And then this is the total number of examples where class happens to be true, divided by the total number of examples. And this does have some nice, oh, wait. Oh, I went away somewhere. That's basically mutual information, and you can think of that computation as being very closely related to the information gain computation. In fact, you can do mutual information with respect to this picture. And under certain conditions, you're basically going to pick the same exact k-top feature. Okay. One advantage, if I think Harlan is on. Yeah, okay. Yeah, this is the one I want. It does satisfy your intuitions. Okay, so for the case where A and B are completely independent. So for example, shirt color and the toss result. If they're independent, okay, then probability of A and B would be probability of A times probability of B. So that would be log of 1, which would be 0. And so the whole in mutual information content for that feature would be 0. Okay? And similarly, if they are completely correlated, that means, let's say one of the columns here is the final, the toss outcome. Or something like maybe this is a biased coin, and it turns out, let's say, that there is a coin of, I guess, that's the coin I have. Okay, so it has heads here, and tails are written in small letters in the bottom. Now, if you toss this coin, essentially, you know what's going to happen. What's going to happen, by the way? Physics. If you toss this coin, would you get heads or tails? Tails, right? So, suppose the shape of the coin, there is some other thing called shape of the coin. Okay, and the shape can be this or just a normal coin. Now, if the shape is this, you know exactly what the class is. In fact, not just norm, the training examples are telling you exactly what the class is. Right? So, in that particular case, what happens is, it's like computing the mutual information between A and A itself, because they are perfectly correlated. Right? So now in that case, if you plug in these things, then you will get it as probability A log of probability of A, where A in this case can be thought of as either the feature probability or the class probability. So in some sense, what we are saying is, if they are perfectly correlated, then that feature's utility is as good as the information content of telling you whether something belongs to this class or not. You have to understand why. Because suppose, irrespective of what the training examples are, okay, I mean, here are bunches of features, and here it's always heads. Right? In that case, is there any point in selecting features? There could be good features, there could be bad features, but there's nothing to learn because everything is a positive example. Okay? So if somebody now comes and tells you, I'm going to tell you what the result of this is going to be, you say, I don't bother, I already know. It's like basically making an elaborate experiment as to whether it's going to be hot or not during June, July, August, on a particular day in Phoenix. If you want to sell that information to people, very few are interested in buying it because they all know that it's going to be hot. It's hot and hotter, there's nothing else. Okay? So it makes sense that ultimately when they're perfectly correlated, the information content of that feature really is the information content of the class itself. If that is zero, then you still would not take any feature. So it's kind of worth understanding why that makes sense. Okay? So now you take this, compute this for each of the features, you know, rank the features and take the top any number, whatever you feel like. And then do the NBC, only on those words. So ignore the probabilities for the rest of the words. Okay? That's what feature selection does. And in general, it helps, it improves performance quite a bit. So actually there is some results here. Which show, this is like an old experiment by a guy who is now at Google, like everybody else. And what he did was, this is Mehran Sahami, what he did was he was trying to classify spam versus non-spam emails, which at the time when he did, it wasn't the big enough problem, but now of course it's a huge problem. Okay. And so he was trying to classify, so junk versus non-junk mails, and so he had like 1789 hand-tagged email messages, hand-tagged, these are, you know, training examples, of which 1578 were shown to have been tagged as junk, and 211 were tagged as legitimate, okay? And so then he did learning to predict a new message, whether it will be junk or non-junk. That's basically the spam filtering, you know, figuring out whether a new message would be spam or not. Okay. And then what he did, if I have this, I don't know what happened. Okay. So what he did was he compared the precision recall, okay, precision recall of spam, junk classification. These are precision recall curves, by the way, the ones that the same things that we know. Okay. You know, you can get very high precision by not removing any mail at all, or just removing only the Nigerian scam mails, and that would not be too many. Okay, and you can get very high recall by removing all the mails, and you, you know, every day you go to the mailbox, you have no mails, and definitely junk mail has been removed. Okay, so the question, of course, is the better ones are the ones which have dominating precision recall curve. Okay, so they did, and this is a classic text classification problem. In the way he were doing, they were doing it, it was directly in terms of words. It's just in terms of the content of the messages. And what they wound up doing is, they, for all these experiments, in fact, there's a different curve they don't even show here, but they actually considered this sort of a mutual information gain-based feature selection. If you don't do that, this precision recall curve is worse. So just assume that you have seen it already. Okay. Then on top of it, what they did was, so the 500, top 500 most relevant words versus words plus phrases. Again, remember that once you are into features and you are thinking words are the features, now words are not completely independent. Okay. So certain words occurring together are much more indicative of the class than occurring separately. You know, my classic example for this, for those of you who had to put up with 471, is, you know, in Seinfeld episodes, if one particular guy, let's say either Newman or Seinfeld, is present, you can't tell whether the party is going to be happy or not. But if they both are present, clearly it's going to be an unhappy party because they can't get along well. Okay? So the fact that both are present together is much more indicative. Okay, each of them by themselves are not particularly useful features, but both being present together is a much better feature. Now, one can actually compute that in our scenario too. What you can do is you can, instead of just splitting on individual features, instead of computing the mutual information for individual words, you can compute mutual information for sets of words and the class together. Okay? That's basically like taking subsets of the features. Unfortunately, that's a dumb idea because there are, if there are V vocabulary words, then there are 2 power V subsets of vocabulary words, and how many are you going to compute now? You're going to die in the feature selection. Okay? So instead, what people wind up doing, what these guys wound up doing is using other techniques such as shingling and so on, they computed frequently occurring phrases and made them look as if they are words by themselves. A phrase as a whole, computer science becomes a word. Data structure becomes a word, okay? And if you throw that in, the features will improve in, because the noun, the phrases essentially are more, they wind up oftentimes being present in the top K most relevant features compared to the individual words, okay? And then, of course, there is some other thing that they did, which is domain-specific extra information about any time you have, let's say, Viagra, you know, remove the mail most of the time. Okay, that would be a domain-specific information. Okay. So this was like long back. Now this is not the state of the art for spam filtering. So anyway, so this is the description of their approach I just mentioned just now. So apart from the words, they used some suggestive phrases such as free money, must be over 21, things like that, as if they are actual words. They looked at the domain of the sender. They considered peculiar punctuation in the words and so on. And this is basically extra domain specific information. If you throw that in, you know, your ability to classify junk and non-junk was higher. Okay. This I already did. This basically, why does NBC work? We already talked about it. You know, because even though the computation of the actual probabilities are way off in NBC, all you need is the relative values, not the absolute ones. Okay. Now, since I mentioned spam filtering, I want to actually say a little bit more about spam filtering, which is like a classic text filtering, text classification problem. Okay. Now, in fact, right now, basically one of the best approaches, general approaches for spam filtering is the spam SSL, which is a Linux, whatever, the code sharing project. Okay, and what spam SSN does is it allows domain-specific rules. People can write handwritten rules, okay, and then there is a Bayesian filter, which is the part that I already told you, and they also have a collaborative filter. Okay, now interestingly, this is sort of going into the next part. Basically, you are trying to recommend to the user that certain messages are junk messages. And you can do that recommendation based on domain-specific considerations, based on the content-only considerations, and based on collaborative considerations. Okay. So what this particular spam SSN does is essentially looks at how many people who got this mail actually opened it. Now, one of the nice things is junk mail does have this property that most people get this mail. Okay. Whereas, you know, if you got a Nobel Prize, just you got the Nobel Prize, only you got that mail. Whereas, you know, I just before I left, I was told that I'm selected for a BMW car. And I'm going to show it to my son because he thinks my car isn't good. So apparently I got that free BMW to improve the international peace. That's what they said. So I believe this. Okay. So I think it's reasonable. So the question is, if I'm the only guy who got it, then clearly I'm very happy. But if all of you got it and you didn't open it, or many of you junked it, then I have to start rethinking whether I should fill the form and send them the information such as my credit card that they just wanted to see. That's all, you know, not to really do anything else. So what they do actually in these collaborative filtering ideas are they keep track of everybody who is, you know, removing a message and putting it into spam. If they have this thing like a Whipple's Razor, which is another program, which is part of spam filtering, Whipple's Razor is because Whipple made this. And all it does is it computes the checksum for your message, and it remembers that you junked it, and it sends it to a central server saying a message with the following checksum has been junked. Now, if 50 people do this, then that's very good indication that it's probably junk. Okay, so when spam SSN is trying to classify a message into junk versus non-junk, it would take these rules, these domain-specific rules, these Bayesian filter ideas, and this collaborative filter, combine all of them to figure out a weight as to what is the possibility, what's the probability that this is junk. You know, now the weights also are, you can either provide it, mostly actually these are provided upfront, and you can change them in the customization. Okay. Now, of course, this problem with this kind of classification is that, in fact, Whipple's Razor was working extremely well for a while, like about a month, before spam filtering guys figured out that, yo, okay, you are computing checksum, right? So what do? I throw in an extra few spaces. I throw in extra few commas, or I throw in extra few dollar signs or something that kills your checksum. So then Whipple then says, Whipple's filter 2, which removes some of the spaces, some of the dollars, and recomputes the checksum. Or it actually computes multiple checksums and then stores what is the thing. And then spam guys will compute a different way of writing the message. Right? Right now, most of the messages that are spam messages that are not caught well are what? Images. Because nobody knows yet how to remove image-based spam filtering. Because image recognition is not possible. So of course what you do is you just don't show any images. So most of the mailers just arbitrarily avoid showing you the images. Okay. Now, currently many of these, one of the interesting things is that spam assassin needed to have this collaborative filtering mechanism, which is actually a very useful mechanism, and it needed to have this nice infrastructure wherein your little mail client will then send information to some central server about what you're doing. For Gmail, they own you. All of you have accounts on their machine, so they exactly know what you're doing, so they can do collaborative filtering so much more easily. This is like social networks on Orkut and Friend of Friend. Basically, normal social networks are hard to traverse because I have to come to you and ask you who do you know and then follow them. But then if all of us are forced to put our friends list in our MySpace account, then it's just a nice database. Okay? So collaborative filtering is done, I'm pretty sure. I mean, of course, as everything else, we don't exactly know what Gmail is doing spam detection, but collaborative aspect is one huge big advantage that they have because everybody has accounts in them. Okay? Okay, so this is, I mean, for those of you who haven't seen Spam Assassin, this is how it looks. I have a very good feeling that, in fact, Gmail uses some version of Spam Assassin and adds onto it. Okay, so, you know, if you have Spam Assassin installed, at one point of time I used to do it myself, and, you know, it would actually tell you what particular rules got fired by your machine, your particular message, and for each of those rules it tells you the total amount of weight, you know, for each of them there's a weight, and then when the combined weight is more than a certain value, it's a threshold based classification, then it'll just say it's a junk mail. Of these, in fact, if you look at this piece and look at them in bigger pictures, these are sort of domain specific rules saying HTML message, HTML with MIME and no tags, and things like that. Okay, forged Outlook forwarding system and so on. And this, on the other hand, is a whole bunch of collaborative features. It was received in various collaborative filter servers, saying this particular message, this kind of message has been received at various places and has been tagged to this tag. So you can remove it. Okay. Now, in this particular case, actually, the auto learn is said to be no, in the sense, one of the problems in content-based filtering of this kind is spam can be detected slowly by capturing what you read, what you don't read, but before it detects, you lose your patience. Okay, that's why nobody uses a spam filtering system unless it's already 99% accurate. And then you can improve it further. 99 doesn't actually count, like 99.99% accurate, and then it should be improved further. Okay, learning is asymptotically going to find out exactly what you consider to be spam, what you don't consider to be spam. I mean, maybe you're doing a PhD dissertation on Nigerian spam, and you want all those mails, and it shouldn't be removed for you. Okay. It could figure that out by just looking at your junking pattern. But oftentimes the collaborative aspects give you a fast bootstrap so that you will start knowing what are junk mails. Okay? And so these are general comments. I actually like the spam because, in fact, I forgot to bring my spam sketch. How many of you know spam sketch? I don't even know why I bother, but this is the, you know, the spam sketch, right? Monty Python spam sketch. Okay. So the word spam. Why did you ask yourself why is spam mail called spam? Why? Of all the words. I mean, nobody says junk mail. They call it spam mail. And, you know, if you are a inquisitive computer science student, you have to find out why it's called spam. And it's called spam because of Monty Python's spam sketch that you must watch to understand why it's called spam mail. Okay. But in terms of solutions to spam, by the way, there is now a conference just for spam mail detection. Okay. In fact, one of the interesting things about spam mail detection is it's a classification problem that is adversarial in nature. And in fact, there is now in machine learning community some work on adversarial classification. So this is, you know, instead of normal classification, if the guy who is generating the class approximately knows how you are classifying and gets to change, then given that, what would be the most robust classifier you can come up with? There's actually a paper in SIGKDD a couple of years back that was the first one to use that word, adversarial classification, by Domingos and a bunch of other people. But it's interesting because spam classification is an adversarial classification. You know, it's not like people won't know that Vipul Srejar is computing the checksum. The moment they know there is a checksum being computed, they change the mail so that that test will fail. Okay, so the relevance of features is constantly changing. Okay, so that's why you need almost a conference for it, which is spam conference. And spam is a technical problem. We sort of created it. It has the arms race character to it. So it was adversarial classification task. We can't quite legislate against spam because it comes outside of national boundaries. And the biggest problem is sending spam doesn't cost anybody anything. Whereas calling by phone, at least, thank God, till now, costs something. But one of these days, believe me, people are going to call me from other countries. Now we have this do not call registry. You know, why can't we have do not mail registry? Because people outside of US don't seem to believe in listening to US. Right? More likely so recently than before. But nobody wants, if we say something, they say exactly the opposite. So we should not be saying anything to the other country. Right? So you cannot legislate it. And so it's interesting that you have do not call registry and it sort of cut down lots of junk calls. I don't know, I mean, you guys may or may not be getting junk calls, but the reduction in the, you know, dinner time calls asking to sell various things to me has reduced significantly now. Okay. Spam mail doesn't come that way because you can't legislate it, and it doesn't also cost. And right now, in fact, thankfully, people are not calling from outside of national boundaries because international calling is costly. But I'm very worried because of all this internet-based calling, because that also is gone, and so it too will start. Okay. What else did you say? So here are some interesting ideas. You know, Bill Gates actually, the one idea that people have is to make it cost something. Why don't we get as much junk mail in postal mail? Because they actually have to pay a little bit to these poor postal guys to deliver that to your doorstep, or a little bit to that guy who has bunch of flyers on his, you know, on his shirt and goes around from door to door putting them. That costs them something, okay? Whereas mails don't cost anything, unfortunately. So there are all sorts of interesting ideas trying to stop people from sending spam by making it hurt. Every time you send spam, it should hurt, okay? One idea was to have this micro cash payments, wherein every time you send a mail, it'll take like a 1 millionth of a cent from some account that you have, which is okay for most normal people because they don't expect to send more than about 1 million messages in a year, so you lose a cent. But it can hurt people who send 1 billion messages per day because then it will actually cost them something. Okay? And a variation on that actually is to every time you send a mail, you would be asked to perform some computation. So the mail server, mail is going between mail servers. So the receiving server asks the sending server, okay, check whether this is a prime number or not. Okay? And it's not that it's asking you to do Nobel Prize quality work. All it does is to check whether it's a prime number or not, you need to look for factors. It takes some time. Okay? For most of even your dumb, 100 megahertz Windows machines, it can still be done. But not if you're sending a billion copies of the same message to a billion people, because then your machine will come to a standstill. Then you can, of course, have a cluster form, but at least I made it hurt because you have to buy machines now. Okay, this is actually one other idea that people are thinking about seriously. Yes? From what? Say. Yeah, that's fine. Then that makes Yahoo worry about who is making our, who is making my, because normally right now if you send, remember that if you are, it's impossible to send huge spam mails using either Yahoo or Gmail's mail servers. Just because you have an account on Yahoo doesn't necessarily mean that you're using their SMTP server. If you try to send a billion mails from SMTP server of Yahoo, just try it. That would be the best way of never having an account with Yahoo again, because they'll make sure very quickly. Okay, I think it's a reasonable idea. An idea which is stupid, and I really get annoyed, is this: there are some bunches of companies which will, intercept your message, send you a message back saying, Rav is busy. If you really are a human person, please answer the following question, and then Rav will deign to talk to you. I may have lost some Nobel Prizes because of this, because people who are trying to give me the prize will go away. Okay, it works, but it's too paranoid. And anytime people ever send me that kind of message, I'll stop ever sending them mail. They avoid spam, but they also avoid Rav, which could be spam for them, but who knows. Anyway, so I think it's an interesting text classification problem with all sorts of interesting overtones. That's it. Okay. Questions? Yes?
What is the connection to this with the LSI?
Okay. I had a slide there. So, again, feature selection, we talked about this actually before. So, feature selection in general is related to dimensionality reduction. And we talked about this. You go back and listen to my old lectures. The difference is, in feature selection, you are assuming that a subset of the given features are what you're trying to pick. In general dimensionality reduction, what you're doing is you're considering linear or nonlinear combinations of the existing features and seeing the best k such feature. So it's no longer features, it's combinations of features that you're computing in dimensionality reduction. So dimensionality reduction for a special case becomes feature selection, but not vice versa. Okay. But having said that, it's interesting to think of what happens with respect to, if you were to do latent semantic indexing kinds of ideas, which is a dimensionality reduction. It's unsupervised dimensionality reduction. That means you don't have any class information. But if you have class information, would LSI change? Okay, so you may have remembered seeing a picture like this. Okay, so if you have your data like this, and if you do LSI, the principal axis would be approximately in this direction. So you're saying this is the most important feature. However, if I also tell you in this data, this is class 1 and this is class 2, and what I'm trying to actually predict is, given a data point, which class it belongs to. Not so much the variance, but which class does it belong to. Okay, then all of a sudden, this is not the best feature. It's in fact something which sort of differentiates both of these, which is something like this is a much better feature. Yes. Oh, okay. It is a much better feature. Okay. This idea, which takes into account the class information and does LSI, is essentially called linear discriminant analysis, LDA. Okay. And in fact, you can think of LSI as a special case of LDA, where each data point is its own class. If each data point is its own class, then LDA is essentially LSI. Okay. If not, then in fact, it's a different optimization that you're doing. You want a feature which is distinguishing the two classes as much as possible while being close for the same class. Okay? And so that's what LDA does. So it does a different optimization, except if each feature, if each point is its own class, then that optimization is the same as what LSI does. So that's the connection between LSI and LDA. Okay. Does that answer the question? Okay. But nobody does LDA for feature selection for text. Okay, because you can get by with just word selection and also phrase detection. That's another way of getting the same effect. Okay. So, are there any other questions? If not, we're going to do recommender systems. Yes. If you have continuous, that means you have continuous variables. Yeah. So, I mean, again, mutual information, again, you know, the problem is it's a tip of the iceberg that I'm interested in because of text data. In text data, there are no real continuous variables. Okay? So it doesn't matter to me. In fact, I was about to say that don't tell Jiping, most of who are probably, some of you are taking the machine learning class, don't tell him that I told you that LDA is not used, because he'll get really mad at me, because he's making a career on LDA. But in, for different data, LDA could be very useful, but for not this data. Okay? Okay. In fact, much of what we've been doing is recommendations. You know, we're recommending people, given this is your query, we think you would be interested in the following pages. Okay? Except, we were just thinking of that recommendation as search, but then a general recommendation problem also might include something like this. This is, I guess, Amazon trying to, you know, tell me, look, you know, you should be buying these books because, you know, people like you seem to be buying these kinds of books. Okay, and now they figured it out somehow that people like me, I mean, so what do they know about me that they can recommend certain books based on what books I bought, based on what they know? And all they know in the case of Amazon is you have a user account, and so they have a profile on you. In particular, they have a profile of what books you bought. And they can take the words appearing in those books as indicative of your interest. So the training data essentially is the books that you did buy are positive examples. The books that you looked at, didn't buy, probably are negative examples. So the rest of the world itself is negative example. So one way of doing it would be, for doing NBC classification on this, could be you consider all the words appearing in the title in the front and the back page of all the books that you bought. And each of them is a document, and the answer is yes. The class is yes. And then you take a random sample of a bunch of other books that you never bought, and those are no. And do NBC on that. Okay, so you now have probabilities, and based on a new book, they can actually tell you with respect to that book, are you likely to be interested in this? Okay, so that's just that's basically direct application of the same text classification technique for book buying recommendation. Okay, so recommenders are instruments of personalization software. Personalization is good for customer relationship management, so that people will feel good that people know them and they're trying to sell them on, you know, various things, especially if they're actually good. And more interestingly, by the way, if you recommend something to somebody, you need a justification as to why are you recommending. A recommender system can't just say, look, you will like it, take it. You know, that way you would not buy them. Okay, so they have to make some sort of a fake explanation as to why they think you will like it. People like explanations, whether they're fake or real. Okay, so Amazon has fake explanations. They will even show you, I believe, I don't know whether they have it, this one doesn't have it. If you go to Amazon now, right, it'll show some books and then it'll say, click here if you want to know why we recommended it to you. They're betting that most likely, unless you're like a 494 geek, you won't click on that. You know. But then you click on it, there is something there. It says, we say this because you bought this, 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 and various other people who bought these kinds of things buy this. Okay, now you feel better somehow. I don't know why, but, you know. So it's an explanation. I mean, people, anytime a friend says, you know, you should see this movie, right? And you would ask, why do you think I should see this movie? And they'll make a fake explanation. And if the fake explanation is good, you'll go see the movie. If not, you won't, right? And so it's very important for recommender systems to have justifications as to why they're recommending. Okay. And now the filtering and recommending, the difference is very little. In the case of filtering, bunches of things are coming. You filter out the bad ones, only show the good ones to the user. So in some sense, you're recommending. That's actually, I would say, text search is filtering. Of all the many, many documents which have these words, these are the ones I think you should see. So I filtered away the bad ones. Spam filtering is a recommendation too. It's removing the spam and keeping the rest. Okay? And then the recommendation is much more like what Amazon does. Predicting would be such as, based on what you have done in the past, what you are likely to do next. That's also useful. Okay, this is based on the user interactions, you're trying to guess what they're more likely to do. And this is sort of like, you know, how many of you have seen MASH? Sheesh. I should go to the old people's homes and start teaching there, because other than me, nobody else seems to have seen any of the shows. But so in the MASH, there is this character called Radar who is completing his boss's words most of the time for the boss, and most of the boss's words and desires, everything for the boss. And so that's like a great personal assistant who knows what you want next even before you ask. And that's what you want in auto completion, auto other things. Okay, that's basically predicting. Okay, feedback, prediction, recommendation. So this is, you know, traditional IR itself is recommendation. Web search engines have one advantage in doing this recommendation, which is that there are billions of users searching for the same thing. And so you have this notion of collaborative search, which is actually very easy to do. Okay, I talked about collaborative in the spam filtering approach, right? Now, imagine the following thing. If somebody came, knocked on your door and tried to sell you something physically, now you're trying to figure out, should I buy this from them or not? Nowadays, of course, everybody has a gun, and whenever somebody knocks on the door, they shoot them. But in the old days, they'll actually open and try to talk to this guy. Now, in the back of your mind, you're wondering, yeah, it looks like a good deal, but is this person trying to put one over me or not? What you would really like to do is very quickly call everybody on the street, you know, and say, did any of you actually figure out anything about this guy? Right? And that's what we were doing in the past, except it's a painful collaborative filtering. The moment you have a single database where people who already threw this guy out have mentioned that, you know, such and such a person, throw them out. Checksum, you know, whatever, you know, Jehovah's Witness checksum, throw them out. You know, I don't know, if you like Jehovah's Witness, don't throw them out. So we were doing collaborative filtering in the past. It was painful. I mean, I like this point for some weird reason. You know, social networks, we were doing social networks before. It was painful. Now you force everybody to put their entire social network on a single database. Of course, it's easy. Okay, you incentivize them somehow such that they'll put their entire lives at your fingertips. And once in a while, you can then come out if you're Google and say, yeah, we're thinking of your privacy once in a while. And that makes it all worthwhile somehow. You know, you shouldn't feel bad anymore. Okay. So you have your entire life, and so it's easy to do collaborative filtering across multiple users. Because of many users, you can do collaborative filtering. Okay. This is all, you know, all this recommender system stuff. You can recommend any kinds of things. Now, one interesting thing, actually, in terms of recommender systems is, where do you get the feedback? You know, in essence, you need the training examples. Now, one of the interesting things you will see in this paper, I mean, when I'm doing this discussion, and a part of it I'll do next class too, but go back and read this Google paper, because they are talking about where do they get their feedback versus what does Amazon do, for example. One of the nice things is, like in Amazon, if you bought a book, you voted with your wallet. You know, you voted with your money. So that must be real rating. Okay? Whereas if you just looked at a page for a few seconds, that doesn't necessarily mean anything. You could be a bot. Right? And in fact, you'll read in this paper that one of the things they were trying to do is to suggest to a random user what kind of news articles are they likely to be interested in on the news.google.com portal. Now, one of the things they found is the most voracious readers of the news are not people at all, because they are clicking like million clicks a second, and they haven't seen too many people who can click that many. Okay, so they must be bots, right? So the question, of course, is how do you get untainted rating information? In places like Amazon, you pay the money, so that means something. Okay, in places like IMDb, where you are rating movies, okay, unfortunately, there's not much other than the fact that you have an account. You must have an account before you get to rate, and nobody removes you. Okay, but it's not as effective a rating information as if you actually paid for your rating. Okay, for example, on things like trust ratings on eBay, etc., you only get to give the trust rating after you bought something from this guy. So if you really want to kind of start yelling at somebody, you can't just send yelling. You know, you have to actually first buy a couple of things, and the more yells you want to do, the more things you have to buy. So you're paying for your opinion. You know, that helps a lot, okay, in terms of getting good feedback. Now, the other interesting thing is intrusive versus non-intrusive feedback computation. Okay, so are you going to actually, intrusive means you ask the user, do you like this? You know, unfortunately, nobody ever fills those kinds of forms. You know, I mean, they try to give you money and they'll say, you know, here are 10,000 questions, you fill this, you'll get $10, and nobody seems to do it, even people like me who have no money. But intrusive is hard, non-intrusive is the way to go. And it's a question of actually engineering feedback is hard. Once you get the feedback, this is sort of like relevant feedback, by the way. And we ask these questions in the context of relevant feedback. How do you get the feedback? Okay. Now, having said all this, if you got the feedback, then you have a bunch of training examples and you're trying to, you know, guess what things are you likely to be interested in. You could do clearly simple content-based filtering, which is classification techniques. So you define each book in terms of the words that appear in the front page and the back page of the book. Those are its features now. And you know whether you bought it or not, so that's the class information. And you take a random sample of books that you never bought, and those are the negative ones. And you can do direct classification techniques. Naive-Bayes classifier is the first thing everybody tries. Okay, now that's, in the context of recommendation systems, that's called content-based filtering. Because you are actually taking the content of these items that you're buying and using that to classify whether you'll like an item or not like an item. The other one essentially is collaborative filtering, where all you care about is you should buy this because other people who have bought things like you bought also bought this. Okay? And since we just spent too much time talking about content-based filtering, let's talk about collaborative filtering for the next few minutes, next 5 minutes. Okay? So all a collaborative filtering approach does is the following thing. You have a user database, and for each user, these are the different users, and for each item, they gave a rating for the item. The rating could be Boolean, saying 1 and 0, or it could be like a rating on scale of 0 to 10 as to whether it's good or bad. Okay. Now, given these, all these users exist in the database. Now, it may be the case, let's say you are this user, you're upside down, and you have no rating for B. That means you never looked at B. Okay. What I can see is, to the extent you are most similar to, let's say, this guy, who is also upside down, surprisingly enough, probably you would like this 4. You would think that this has weight 4. I mean, this has relevance 4 to you. Because people like you seem to be liking B at the level of 4 out of 10. That's all collaborative filtering is. Okay. Now, anyway. This is the slide that you want to understand, because once you understand this slide, you would already feel that you know collaborative filtering. Okay, the specifics that I will discuss in next class are just specifics. Okay. all you have is an item user matrix. Each user is a row, each item is a column, there is a number. Okay, so ith user jth item k, that means ith user likes jth item at the rating k. That's all. Okay, that's an item user matrix. Now if you have item user matrix, think of users as documents. Think of items as keywords. Everything you did for documents and keywords, you can do here. So for example, you can say each user is a vector in the space of items. So if you want to figure out who is the most, the user who is most similar to you, who is the user who is most similar to you, okay, what do? You look at the vector similarity between this user's item vector, the other user's item vector. That's all. Okay? Now, you can cut out users completely, and you can say which items seem to be co-occurring with which other items in the buying lists of people. That's like, given a keyword, what are the other keywords that are most likely related keywords? When did we do this? Scalar clustering. Why did we do it? Because we wanted to elaborate the query. Somebody said, show me pages which has this word, and you said, why don't you like some other word also, this word extra? Because people who like this word seem to like this word. That's exactly what we did in scalar clustering. Okay? So if you do this for items, that's collaborative filtering. Okay, so one version of doing collaborative filtering is essentially to just compute scalar clusters for items. And for each item, you know the n closest items to it. And anytime you buy this item, you try to push this other item. Okay? Another way of doing the same idea is, given the user, given you are about to, you know, given you just logged into Amazon, you have your user vector becomes the current user vector. I can quickly compute who are the closest users to you, most similar users to you, and then try to tell you, buy everything those guys bought. You know, I am a seller. You know, the better, the more things I sell, I'm better off. Okay, so that's what I would like to do in that particular case. Okay. Now here's an interesting thing, though. This is the last slide, and in fact, you should just think about this. Next class, we will talk about, you know, one method for doing collaborative filtering plus what they do in the Google paper. Okay, but one interesting thing is, you would think that the most similar user might well be the person that you are sort of most related to. Maybe your wife would be the most similar user, your friend would be the most similar user, but that's bogus, because husbands and wives can't see the same movie together most of the time. Okay? And so in fact, having friends circle doesn't necessarily help. These are virtual friends now. You know, these are people you don't know, but they have the same sort of taste in items that you seem to have. Okay, now if I do figure out, and this is the word that I want you to remember, if I do figure out user similarity, and I could, if you don't know any other idea, think of finding user similarity using vector similarity, because it's a vector. Just that idea. We'll do a better idea, but that's a reasonable idea. Okay, then compute the k nearest neighbors for the user. Okay, compute the k nearest neighbor, and then use k nearest neighbor classification to predict whether you would like a particular item or not. In fact, if you are looking at the rating, then you do k nearest neighbor regression instead of k nearest neighbor classification. That's all I want to say. Okay, so collaborative filtering is very close to everything that you already know. It's just being done on a different data. It's being done on the social network data, where the social network is implicitly determined in terms of shared buying patterns. The biggest problem in collaborative filtering winds up being that these are large vectors where, so the number of items on Amazon are 59,955 or something, or maybe much more, and I have bought 7 of them till now. So I have ratings for 7 of them, and every other thing I have no ratings at all. It's not that I hate them, it's just I have no ratings for them. So in collaborative filtering, the worst problem is it's great if everybody buys most of the things, then the similarity can be computed well. Unfortunately, most dimensions, the answer is, I don't know. That's the problem with collaborative filtering. And one idea that we'll talk about next time is where you don't yet know whether you would have liked it or not, you can use classification with respect to what you like to fill up whether you would have liked it or not. That would be fake recommendations based on your own content information, and then do collaborative filtering. And this is an idea which combines content-based and collaborative ideas together. And that works better, believe it or not, than normal collaborative filtering. Okay? Let's stop here.